Hello, this is Brian, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 25th issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. By heart baby formula from all lots may be contaminated with botulism bacteria, tests show. Tests of by heart infant formula tied to a botulism outbreak that has sickened dozens of babies showed that all of the company's products may have been contaminated. Laboratory tests of 36 samples of formula from three different lots showed that five samples contained the type of bacteria that can lead to the rare and potentially deadly illness, the company said Monday on its website. Based on these results, we cannot rule out the risk that all by heart formula across all product lots may have been contaminated, the company wrote. At least 31 babies in 15 states who consumed by heart formula have been sickened in the outbreak that began in August, according to federal and state health officials. In addition, other infants who drank by heart formula were treated for botulism in earlier months, as far back as November 2024, although they are not counted in the outbreak, officials said. Clostridium botulinum type A, the type of bacteria detected, can be unevenly distributed in powdered formula. Not all babies who ingest it will become ill, though all infants under age one are at risk, medical experts said. ByHeart recalled all of its formula nationwide on November 11. However, some product has remained on store shelves despite the recall, according to state officials and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Parents and caregivers should stop feeding the formula to babies immediately and monitor the children for symptoms, which can take up to 30 days to appear. Infant botulism occurs when babies ingest spores that germinate in their intestine and produce a toxin. Symptoms include constipation, difficulty sucking or feeding, drooping eyelids, flat facial expression, and weakness in the arms, legs, and head. The illness is a medical emergency and requires immediate treatment. At least 107 babies nationwide have been treated for botulism with an IV medication known as Baby Big since August 1. Health officials said. In a typical year, less than 200 infants are treated for the illness. To report an illness tied to the outbreak, contact an FDA consumer complaint coordinator or fill out an online MedWatch form. Consumers who bought ByHeart on the company's website on or after August 1 can receive a full refund, an expansion of its previous policy, the company said. Four more arrested in $102 million Louvre jewel heist, Paris prosecutor says. The Paris prosecutor announced four more arrests Tuesday in connection with the stunning heist at the Louvre Museum in October by a gang that made off with $102 million worth of jewels. The two men and two women taken into custody are from the Paris region and range in age from 31 to 40, said the prosecutor, Laura Bacall, whose office is heading the investigation. Her statement didn't say what role they're suspected of having played in the October 19 theft. Police can hold them for questions for 96 hours. French media report that one of those arrested, a 39-year-old already known to police services, is believed to be the fourth member of the team thought to have carried out the daring daylight robbery and is from Aubervilliers, a suburb north of Paris other suspects have connections with. The other three alleged members of the so-called commando team have been previously arrested and face preliminary charges of theft by an organized gang and criminal conspiracy. Their DNA has been found on the scene or on items linked to the robbery. A woman arrested in October is accused of complicity. The loot hasn't been recovered. It includes a diamond and emerald necklace Napoleon gave to Empress Marie-Louise, jewels tied to 19th century Queens Marie-Amélie and Hortense and Empress Eugenie's pearl and diamond tiara. The robbery has focused attention on security at the Louvre, the world's most visited museum. The thieves took less than 8 minutes to force their way into the museum and leave, using a freight lift to reach the building's window. Footage from museum cameras showed two broke into the ornate Apollo Gallery, cutting into the jewelry display cases with disc cutters and making off with the trove, while two riders on scooters whisked them away. The emerald set imperial crown of Napoleon III's wife, Empress Eugenie, containing more than 1,300 diamonds, was later found outside the museum. More people are addicted to marijuana, but fewer of them are seeking help, experts say. Megan Feller smoked pot several times a day and couldn't eat, sleep, or function without it. But at the time, she didn't see the need to reach out for help. "I didn't think cannabis was a big deal," the 24-year-old said. "It was really socially accepted." This attitude is common. As more states legalize marijuana, use has become more normalized and products have become more potent. But fewer of those who are addicted seek help for it. Pot use among young adults reached historic levels in recent years, according to a federally supported survey. Daily use even outpaced daily drinking, with nearly 18 million Americans reporting in 2022 that they use marijuana every day or nearly every day, up from less than 1 million 3 decades earlier. Studies show a corresponding increase in cannabis use disorder when people crave marijuana and spend lots of time using it, even though it causes problems at home, school, work, or in relationships. It's a condition that researchers estimate affects about 3 in 10 pot users and can be mild, moderate, or severe. And it's an addiction, despite the common misconception that that's not possible with marijuana, said Dr. Smita Das, an addiction psychiatrist at Stanford University. Meanwhile, the drug's widespread acceptance has fueled a stigma about seeking treatment, said Dr. Jennifer Exo of the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation in Minnesota. "There's this pervasive belief that you can't become addicted. It can't actually be a problem," she said. "It has to do with this myth that cannabis is safe, natural, and benign. Stronger weed, bigger problems. While pot isn't as harmful as harder drugs, frequent or heavy use has been linked to problems with learning, memory, and attention, as well as chronic nausea, vomiting, and lung problems among those who smoke it. Some evidence has also linked it to earlier onset of psychosis in people with genetic risk factors for psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. And today's pot is not the same as that of the past. Many people recall older relatives who smoked a few doobies and ate some food and fell asleep," Exo said. "But it's absolutely different. In the 1960s, most pot that people smoked contained less than 5% THC, the ingredient that causes a high. Today, the THC potency in cannabis flower and concentrates sold in dispensaries can reach 40% or more, according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Teens are often vaping potent marijuana concentrates, Exo said, rather than eating brownies made with cannabis flower or taking a hit from a bong. More access to marijuana, rising ER visits. Pot is also increasingly available, though it's still a federal crime to possess it. 24 states allow recreational use by adults, and 40 allow medical use as of late June, the National Conference of State Legislatures said. Dispensaries abound, and more people are able to keep pot at home. Research links the legalization of recreational marijuana with rising emergency room visits for acute cannabis intoxication in which patients may experience a rapid heartbeat or feel dizzy, confused, or paranoid. A study last year focused on Michigan found that legalization was associated with an immediate increase in the rate of ER visits for this condition among people of all ages, especially middle-aged adults. Doss said increased access to cannabis, along with a growing number of cannabis products and with higher potency, all contribute to rising ER visits. Edibles such as gummies can pose a particular problem because they take a little while to kick in, so people may keep taking more because they don't yet feel the drug's effects. Then suddenly, they're suffering from cannabis toxicity, she said. Why treatment is often overlooked. Feller first tried pot at 16 and quickly went from smoking the plant to using vape cartridges that were easy to hide in her pocket. Soon, she could barely get by without it. I would wake up every morning for years, and until I smoked weed, I would throw up, she said. Instead of trying to get high, she used it to make these other symptoms go away. Feller was also drinking a lot, and her parents sent her to a treatment center when she was around 18. It didn't help because she wasn't ready to get well. After her mother died, her substance use worsened. At 22, Feller entered Hazelden on her own, but only to get sober from alcohol, which she did. She kept using pot on and off, then finally sought treatment for cannabis use disorder, and has been sober from marijuana for almost a year. I'm so much happier now, she said. I don't feel like shackled to a substance. Such treatment is often overlooked, said Brian Graves, a researcher at Florida Atlantic University. He and his colleagues published a study this year showing that the share of people who got treatment for cannabis use disorder from their nationally representative sample dropped from 19% in 2003 to 13% in 2019. An earlier study also found a marked decline and pointed to reasons that include expanding cannabis legalization, and more tolerant attitudes. Experts said people need to be educated that pot, like alcohol, can be misused and cause real harm. Another important piece is helping people understand the risk before they start, Exo said, and then to feel safe enough to say, hey, I need help managing this. Many people wait until their marijuana use causes problems in multiple parts of their lives before they seek treatment, if they ever do. If you're changing your life because of weed, there might be an issue, Feller added. There are resources to get help, and you are not alone. A tornado damages homes near Houston as rain falls in the south and snow comes down in the Midwest. Residents in more than 100 homes north of Houston faced lots of cleanup Tuesday following a tornado that tore off roofs and smashed windows as heavy rain fell in the south and snow came down in parts of the Midwest this Thanksgiving travel week. No injuries were reported in the storm Monday that uprooted trees, downed power lines, and created paths of debris throughout some neighborhoods. National Weather Service staff were expected to survey the area to determine if multiple tornadoes had struck. Heavy fog made it difficult to assess all the damage Tuesday morning on an otherwise calm day. Meanwhile, multiple rounds of storms and showers were expected in Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. Heavy rain shut down air traffic control operations for about 10 minutes at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport. But things were back to normal, a spokesperson said. The storm system was expected to move to the northeast by Tuesday night, with another one in the forecast in the Pacific Northwest. Even though the official start of winter is nearly a month away, a winter storm was developing in the northern part of the country, with snow falling in North Dakota. That's impacting North Dakota, Minnesota, including Minneapolis, and then portions of the northern Great Lakes, said Weather Service meteorologist Mark Chenard in College Park, Maryland. Snowfall was expected into Wednesday, he said. The holiday itself looked dry, cold, and breezy for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York, with lake effect snow expected through Friday. It's pretty narrow bands, but there'll be some significant snowfall accumulations across off the lakes in Michigan and western New York, Chouinard said. More winter weather could arrive in the central and northern parts of the country over the weekend, he said. In Texas, some people hunkered down in their homes and hid in closets during the storm. More than 20,000 customers were without power at one point Monday. I had the door, and I was trying to hold it shut so that nothing would end up in the house, Miriam Harris told KTRK-TV. It was so forceful. She suffered roof and tree damage, and some of her holiday light display was mangled. In Klein, about 25 miles north of Houston, officials were working to fix multiple reported gas leaks, remove trees that were blocking roads, and clean up debris around homes and businesses, said Jamila Lomas, spokesperson for the Klein Fire Department. Damage also was reported in Cypress and Spring. One engine crew temporarily took shelter in a resident's garage as high winds moved through the area, posted the Cy-Fair Fire Department, which represents a collection of stations throughout the Houston region. Photos and drone video posted on Facebook by the Harris County Precinct 4 Constable showed roofs with shingles ripped off, some debris blocked roads. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Some DACA recipients have been arrested in the Trump's immigration crackdown. Yakub Vihendre was preparing to go to work as a mechanic when six vehicles appeared outside his Dallas area home. Federal agents jumped out. One pointed a weapon at him, and they took him into custody. Vihendre is a recipient of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the Obama-era program that has shielded hundreds of thousands of people from deportation since 2012 if they were brought to the United States as children and generally stayed out of trouble. The Trump administration said it targeted Vihendre over social media posts. The freelance videographer and pro-Palestinian activist described his early October arrest to his attorneys, who relayed the information to reporters. His arrest and several others this year signal a change in how the U.S. is handling DACA recipients as President Donald Trump's administration reshapes immigration policy more broadly. The change comes as immigrants have faced increased vetting, including of their social media, when they apply for visas, green cards, citizenship, or to request the release of their children from federal custody. The administration also has sought to deport foreign students for participating in pro-Palestinian activism. DACA was created to shield recipients, commonly referred to as Dreamers, from immigration arrests and deportation. It also allows them to legally work in the U.S. Recipients reapply every 2 years. Previously, if their status was in jeopardy, they would receive a warning and would still have a chance to fight it before immigration officers detained them and began efforts to deport them. In response to questions about any changes, Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin issued a statement saying that people who claim to be recipients of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, are not automatically protected from deportations. DACA does not confer any form of legal status in this country. DACA recipients can lose status for a number of reasons, including if they've committed a crime, she said. McLaughlin also claimed in a statement that Vihendre made social media posts glorifying terrorism, including one she said celebrated Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, al-Qaeda's leader in Iraq, who was killed in a U.S. strike in 2006. An attorney for Vihendre, Chris Goodshall Bennett, said Vihendre's social media activity is clearly protected speech. He also said the government has not provided details about the specific posts and court documents. Vihandre is among about 20 DACA recipients who have been arrested or detained by immigration authorities since Trump took office in January, according to Home Is Here, a campaign created by pro-DACA advocacy groups. The administration is seeking to end his DACA status, which could result in him being deported to the Philippines, a home he has not visited since his family came to the U.S. in 2001 when he was 14. DACA has faced legal challenges. DACA survived the first Trump administration's attempt to rescind the program when the Supreme Court ruled in 2020 that the administration did not take the proper steps to end it. There have been other attempts to end the program or place restrictions on recipients. This year, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a ruling that would deny work permits for DACA recipients who live in Texas. The Trump administration recently presented its plans to a federal judge who is determining how it will work. The administration also has issued new restrictions on commercial driver's licenses that would prevent DACA recipients and some other immigrants from getting them. Last year, 19 Republican states stripped DACA recipients' access to health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, and the number of states where immigrant students can qualify for in-state tuition has dwindled since the Justice Department began suing states this year. This administration might not be trying to end DACA altogether the way they did the first time around, but they are chipping away at it, said Juliana Macedo do Nascimento, spokesperson for United We Dream, which is part of Home Is Here, the coalition keeping track of public cases of DACA recipients who have been detained. Detained DACA recipients questioned their arrests. Catalina Social Santiago, 28-year-old activist from El Paso, Texas, was arrested in August despite showing immigration officers a valid work permit obtained through DACA. Days later, federal officers arrested Paulo Cesar Gomez Lira as the 28-year-old father was arriving at his El Paso home with his children following a doctor's appointment. Agents dislocated his shoulder, according to his attorneys. Both Santiago and Gomez Lira were held for over a month while their attorneys petitioned for their release. Marissa Ong, an attorney for Santiago and Gomez Lira, said the government failed to notify either of her clients of any intention to terminate their DACA status. DACA recipients have a constitutionally protected interest in their continued liberty, Ong said, adding that the government cannot take away that liberty without providing some valid reason. DACA recipients can lose their status if they are convicted of a felony, significant misdemeanors like those involving harming others, driving under the influence, or drug distribution, or three or more misdemeanors. They can also lose their status if they pose a threat to national security or public safety. DHS claimed in a statement that Santiago was previously charged with trespassing, possession of narcotics, and drug paraphernalia, and that Gomez Lira was previously arrested for marijuana possession. Ong said that when attorneys sought their release, the government presented no evidence of any past misconduct by either individual. Vihandre, the Dallas area man who was arrested in October, remains in a Georgia detention facility. His attorneys say he received notice 2 weeks before his arrest that the government planned to terminate his DACA status, but that he wasn't given a chance to fight it. I think that the administration has drawn a very clear line, and at least for right now, between citizen and non-citizens, and their goal is to remove as many non-citizens from the country as possible and to make it as difficult as possible for non-citizens to enter the country. Godshall Bennett, Vihandre's attorney said. Airport chapels stay on the radar of workers and travelers, even as role of faith in public shifts. With peak holiday travel starting just after the government shutdown's flight restrictions, hope for a moment of peace at an airport can feel like a wing and a prayer. But quiet and worship are just what airport chapels have provided for decades to travelers and to the airport workers that many were originally designed for. I love seeing travel bags and workers' outfits. It gives hope that you're ministering to a need, said the Reverend Brian Daly, one of the priests at Our Lady of the Airways at Boston's Logan International Airport. Built in the 1950s so that airport employees could attend Mass right in their sprawling workplace, it's widely considered the first airport chapel in the United States. It's also among the last to still function as a Catholic church instead of an interfaith space. Though Muslim prayer rugs discreetly placed on the rear pews show it welcomes a variety of believers. Midday on a Friday, a man rolling a carry-on suitcase prayed for a few minutes on a rug in the back of the brick-faced chapel on the cavernous ground floor of Terminal C. Donning reflective vests, a sprinkling of airline employees also darted in, knelt in the pews, and hurried back to work after making the sign of the cross with blessed water. I come here almost every day to pray for a few minutes, said Brian Babcock, a Southwest Airlines baggage handler who stopped by Boston's chapel in his orange vest at the beginning of his shift. It's awesome that I have a chapel within walking distance of where I work. Workers' chapels open at airports. The mid-20th century impetus behind constructing Our Lady of the Airways, as well as the two other Catholic chapels that followed at what's now New York's JFK and Chicago's O'Hare airports, stemmed from the church's desire to reach the faithful at their workplaces. Earlier, Pope Leo XIII had published the document Rerum Novarum, which was an inspiration for the current first U.S. Pope to adopt the name Leo XIV and focused on social doctrine and workers' rights. Inspired by it, church leaders such as Boston's Cardinal Richard Gushing started building chapels at train stations, on fishing docks, in downtown commercial hubs, and at airports that were expanding into commercial aviation. He really had a program for establishing chapels for working people, said James O'Toole, Professor Emeritus of History at Boston College. Boston's Catholicism was overwhelmingly a working-class phenomenon. Thousands of people worked at Logan, often on 12-hour shifts that could fall on Sundays or holy days, when Catholics have an obligation to attend Mass, so Our Lady of the Airways was built to accommodate them. Even when offering 6 weekend masses, it became so popular it quickly outgrew its first space, so the current larger chapel was built in 1965. Up front is the original metal statue of the Virgin Mary, her feet resting on a globe as 3 airplanes fly around it. You couldn't get in there, recalled John Capucci, who started attending the packed mass as a child. More than 70 years later, he's now among a few dozen weekly mass goers because he likes the streamlined worship style. It's quiet and peaceful, he said. Among nationwide declining religiosity and a shortage of priests, only one mass is now celebrated at Our Lady on Sundays by the pastors responsible for a nearby parish that covers 2 churches and another Marian shrine too, but who still want to preserve the airport outreach. They need to be reached in the secular world where they are, Daly said of the travelers and workers, Catholic and not, he ministers to at the airport. From chapels to interreligious meditation spaces, Protestant and Jewish faith leaders also established chapels at U.S. airports in the 1970s and 1980s, offering quiet space for individual prayer rather than organized services like their Catholic counterparts. Over the past 30 years, most U.S. airport chapels have turned interfaith with removable symbols of different religions, or none in the newer meditation spaces that have been created, said Wendy Cage, president and professor of sociology at Bryn Mawr College. I'm not aware of any that have been built recently that are anything other than kind of warm waiting rooms, Cage added. Tucked behind baggage claims or above food courts, chapels are idiosyncratic, influenced by the local history and demographics, as well as sometimes tensely negotiated arrangements between local faith leaders and municipal and airport authorities. These range from rent, which is often nominal, to whether worship services can be announced over the PA system. While it's unclear how many people use the spaces across the country, much of the more religiously observant demand recently has come from Muslims, Cage said. Interfaith worship among taxiing planes. Printouts of the Muslim prayer timetable and the 2025 Catholic and Protestant Christmas season Mass and worship service schedule are tacked by the door of the chapel at Chicago's O'Hare Airport, where about 50,000 people work and 80 million annually fly in or out. Chaplaincy at O'Hare started in 1960 when Catholic workers asked a nearby parish priest to come celebrate Mass. The first chapel was a United Airlines training room. Then the faithful gathered in a basement space they called Community of Our Lady of Loreto, with makeshift furniture from airport concessionaires and up to 8 Masses each weekend, according to diocesan histories. In the 1990s, a few years after the current chapel was established on the mezzanine above the check-in counters at Terminal 2, it became an interfaith space, its glass walls open to a view of taxiing airplanes. A compass rose on the ceiling shows the direction to Mecca, and a small light stands by the tall tabernacle where the consecrated host is kept for daily Catholic Mass. Everybody is grateful to have a quiet place to pray, said the Reverend Michael Zagnolo, the Catholic priest who is administrator of the Interfaith Airport Chapels of Chicago. Our first customer is the airport worker. The traveler is the frosting on the cake. He said the airport badge he wears on his clergy apparel is an instant conversation starter for those he encounters at the terminal. He hears confessions almost daily, even as Mass attendance has shrunk in the 25 years he's been at O'Hare. Zagnolo hopes the chapel won't turn into a generic meditation space, both to honor the Catholic roots of what's now the Pope's hometown and to serve the faithful of different religions. Back in Boston, two Catholic JetBlue gate workers shared the hope that Our Lady of the Airways can stay open for the blend of nervous flyers and employees of different faiths they see daily among the pews. We come every day to pray before our shift starts, to get some guidance, said Manuel Tejeda Pimentel. It's a little escape. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Photos show aftermath of Russian deadly attacks on Kyiv. Russia launched a wave of attacks on Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, overnight, with at least 6 people killed in strikes that hit city buildings and energy infrastructure. A Ukrainian attack on southern Russia killed 3 people and damaged homes, authorities said. The attacks came during a renewed U.S. push to end the war that has raged for nearly 4 years and talks about a U.S. peace plan. U.S. sanctions high-ranking Haitian official and accuses him of supporting gangs. The U.S. government imposed visa restrictions on Fritz Alphonse Jean, a member of Haiti's Transitional Presidential Council, accusing him of supporting gangs and other criminal organizations in a move expected to deepen the country's political instability. The U.S. did not name the person it sanctioned in its announcement late Monday, but Jean confirmed it was him, telling the Associated Press on Tuesday that he rejected those accusations. The U.S. also accused Jean of obstructing Haiti's fight against terrorist gangs without details. Gangs control 90% of Haiti's capital and swaths of territory in the center of the country, where they extort businesses, kill civilians, and fight for territory using military-grade weaponry. Haiti is due to hold elections by February 7, when the 9-member council is supposed to step down. Critics have asserted that some council members are seeking to stay in power beyond that date and are looking for a new prime minister who would support those plans. Jean dismissed that assertion, saying the council wants to fight gangs and corruption. Once we started reviewing the possibilities of changing the head of government, members of the council started receiving threats of visa cancellation and other sanctions from the U.S. embassy representative and the Canadian ambassador, Jean said. He said the envoys clearly stipulated that if we do not desist, we will face sanctions and visa cancellation. Jean added, "We stand firm on combating corruption, state capture by few individuals, and operators involved in drug trafficking, weapons, and ammunitions proliferation." Jean is an economist and former central bank governor who once served as president of the Transitional Presidential Council. The council was formed after former Prime Minister Ariel Henry resigned last year following widespread gang attacks, leaving Haiti without a leader. The office of Haiti's current Prime Minister, Alex Didier Fils-Aimé, did not immediately return a request for comment. The visa sanctions against Jean came less than a week after U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau warned on social media that there were calls for open war against the central government in Haiti. The U.S. and other countries in the region and around the world have a clear message. Enough with gang violence and destruction and political infighting. Now is the time for Haiti's leaders to unite against a common threat, and anyone who obstructs Haiti's path to political stability must expect consequences from the U.S. and others, including visa revocations, Landau wrote on November 19. Haiti's prime minister and the Transitional Presidential Council have been under pressure to hold elections before the council's mandate expires, but gang violence has made that deadline impossible to meet. Haiti's Provisional Electoral Council has set tentative election dates for August and December of next year. The country hasn't held elections in almost a decade, and no one has been president since former President Jovenel Moïse was fatally shot at his private residence in July 2021. More than 43,000 people, including gang members, have been killed this year from January to September across Haiti. And violence persists. The UN-backed mission, led by Kenyan police, has struggled to contain the violence. And now Haiti awaits a new gang suppression force that would have the power to arrest suspected gang members, which the current force does not have. In another blow to the country, Sunrise Airways, the only airline offering domestic and international flights to Haiti, announced Sunday that it was suspending service for safety reasons. Gang violence has forced Haiti's main international airport to close several times since last year. Everything is soaked. Winter rains in Gaza bring new misery for Palestinians. Children and families in Gaza scooped muddy water from their tents on Tuesday, trying to protect the few belongings that remain after 2 years of war. Winter's heavy rains have left displaced Palestinians splashing in water that reaches their ankles and blaming both Israel and Hamas for the misery that remains despite a ceasefire. "All tents were destroyed," said Asma Fayyad in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, whose shelter was damaged in Tuesday's latest downpour, Where is Hamas? Where are the people to see this rain and how our children are drowning? A Hamas spokesperson, Hazem Qassem, lashed out in a message on Telegram. All the world's efforts to alleviate the disaster have failed because of the Israeli siege. Aid organizations worry that the rainy winter months will make the stark situation worse, with ongoing shortages of humanitarian supplies. They are scrambling to mitigate the flooding and restore infrastructure devastated by the fighting. Nearly all of Gaza's over 2 million people were forced from their homes during the war. Most have been living in tents or shelters, some of them built over destroyed homes, with no proper sewage facilities. For toilets, they depend on cesspits dug near tents that overflow in heavy rainfall. Rain-soaked mattresses. Rahem Al-Hilu was among those assessing the damage in Deir al-Bala, one of the areas hardest hit by the rains. Her wood and metal shelter collapsed overnight, and she said her head was injured. Rainwater flooded the mattresses, she said. As you can see, everything is soaked, the clothes, everything, and my children are all soaked. The United Nations Humanitarian Office last week said the downpours have damaged at least 13,000 tents, like Al-Hilu's, and destroyed what little shelter and belongings thousands of Palestinians in Gaza had left. The office said aid organizations had begun preparing for winter in October, when the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas took effect, transporting materials like winterized tents into Gaza. Aid groups were able to distribute over 3,600 tents, 129,000 tarpaulins, and 87,000 blankets earlier this month, the UN office said. But the office said efforts have been hampered by the slow entry of aid. It said deliveries into the territory continue to be severely constrained by Israeli authorities' restrictions on the entry of shelter supplies. Life-saving humanitarian aid must enter Gaza without obstruction and at scale, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on Tuesday. The Israeli defense body responsible for the entry of aid, COGAT, said it worked on a dedicated response to the winter. The effort is ongoing. Additional winter-related requests by international organizations have already been approved, and entry will take place in the coming days, the agency wrote Tuesday on X. Roads become rivers. Roadways in Deir al-Bala turned into shallow rivers of murky water. One man waded across, carrying a young daughter in each arm. Some families knelt on the ground, trying to soak up the water with pieces of cloth. While daily fighting has stopped in Gaza, Israel continues to strike parts of the territory in response to what it says are violations by Hamas. Both sides have accused each other of violating ceasefire conditions, and many displaced Palestinians remain crowded into the rough half of Gaza's territory that Israeli forces don't control. Two climbers die and two more rescued on New Zealand's highest peak. Two mountain climbers have died on Araki, New Zealand's tallest peak, with two others from the same group rescued, authorities said on Tuesday. The dead climbers' bodies have been found, and specialist searchers were working to recover them in a challenging alpine environment, Police Area Commander Inspector Vicky Walker said. None of the climbers have been publicly identified. Sergeant Kevin McErlin told the Timaru Herald the pair had been connected by a rope when they fell near the summit of Araki, also known as Mount Cook. The authorities learned late Monday night local time that four climbers needed help on the mountain, which is on New Zealand's South Island. Two of the climbers were rescued by helicopter in the early hours of Tuesday morning, Walker said. They were uninjured. Searchers in two helicopters looked throughout the night for the other climbers, who were found dead hours later. Araki is 12,218 feet high and is part of the Southern Alps, the scenic and icy mountain range that runs the length of the South Island. A settlement of the same name at its base is a destination for domestic and foreign tourists. The peak is popular among experienced climbers. Its terrain is technically difficult due to crevices, avalanche risk, changeable weather, and glacier movement. More than 240 deaths have been recorded on the mountain and in the surrounding national park since the start of the 20th century. Dozens of those who died on the mountain have never been found. This includes three men, two from the United States and one from Canada, who were believed to have died on Oroki in December 2024. The Americans, Kurt Blair, 56, from Colorado, and Carlos Romero, 50, of California, were certified alpine guides. The climbers were missing for 5 days before New Zealand authorities halted a search for them, saying discoveries of their belongings suggested the men had fallen to their deaths. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Israel says it has received another set of human remains from militants in Gaza. Israel on Tuesday said it received human remains that Palestinian militants handed over to the Red Cross, but it was not immediately clear if they were one of the three hostages remaining in the Gaza Strip. The remains were then taken for forensic testing and identification in Tel Aviv. The handover is the latest under last month's fragile ceasefire that has held despite accusations by both sides of violations. Palestinian Islamic Jihad said it found the remains earlier this week in Nusayrat, a refugee camp in central Gaza. Palestinian militants have returned 25 bodies of hostages under the ceasefire deal that went into effect on October 10. The remaining hostages are two Israelis and a man from Thailand. In return, Israel has released the bodies of 330 Palestinians to Gaza. Most remain unidentified. Under Israeli pressure to hurry, Hamas says it has not been able to reach all the remains of hostages because they are buried under rubble from Israel's two-year offensive. Israel has accused the militants of dragging their feet and threatened to resume military operations or withhold humanitarian aid if all remains are not returned. Netanyahu's office asserted that the delay amounted to a ceasefire violation. A rising death toll in Gaza. While daily fighting has stopped, the death toll has gone up as Israel strikes parts of Gaza in response to what it says are ceasefire violations by Hamas. Gaza's health ministry on Tuesday said Israeli forces killed three people east of Khan Yunis in the south. It said the bodies were brought to hospitals along with 14 others recovered from the rubble over the past 24 hours. Those brought the death toll to 345 Palestinians since the ceasefire took effect, the ministry said. On Tuesday night, Israel's military said it killed five militants emerging from a tunnel in Rafah in southern Gaza, and another who crossed into an Israeli-held part of northern Gaza and approached troops. The war began when the Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on October 7, 2023, that killed some 1,200 people and took over 250 hostages. Almost all of the hostages or their remains have been returned in ceasefires or other deals. Gaza's health ministry says 69,775 Palestinians have been killed and 170,863 injured in Israel's retaliatory offensive. It does not distinguish between civilians and combatants in its figures, but has said women and children make up a majority of those killed. The ministry is staffed by medical professionals and maintains detailed records viewed as generally reliable by independent experts. Meanwhile, families in Gaza confronted heavy winter rains that worsened dire humanitarian conditions for many of the 2 million people displaced by the war. Planning for Gaza Stabilization Force. Planning was underway for an international stabilization force mandated by the UN last week during the approval of Washington's 20-point blueprint to secure and govern Gaza. Indonesia said Tuesday it was preparing troops. Officials said the final deployment would await an official order from Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto, who has said his country was ready to deploy 20,000 peacekeepers to Gaza at any time. General Agus Subianto, chief of the Indonesian Armed Forces, told reporters the contingent would be a brigade consisting of health, engineering, and mechanized support battalions, and that the military was preparing other support, including three hospital warships, a C-130 Hercules military transport aircraft, and a helicopter. The U.S. plan also includes a transitional authority to be overseen by President Donald Trump and envisions a possible future path to an independent Palestinian state. Seeking visits for detained Palestinians. Israeli human rights organization Hamokht, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, and the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel filed a petition on Tuesday to Israel's High Court calling on authorities to resume family visits for Palestinian prisoners suspected of being militants. Family visits were suspended at the beginning of the war in Gaza. Since then, the number of Palestinians dying in Israeli custody has surged, and prison populations have doubled. Rights groups allege systematic violence and denial of medical care as key causes of death. Hamokht attorney Daniel Shenhar said, "Israel has almost completely cut off Palestinian prisoners and detainees from the outside world." A Pope Mobile for Gaza. The Catholic charity Caritas on Tuesday unveiled the late Pope Francis's so-called Pope Mobile in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Per Francis's request, it has been transformed into a mobile health clinic and is supposed to be sent to Gaza to help care for children. "This vehicle stands as a testament. The world has not forgotten the children of Gaza," said Cardinal Anders Arborelius, the Bishop of Stockholm, Sweden. Sudan's top general rejects U.S.-led ceasefire proposal, calling it the worst yet. Sudan's top general rejected a ceasefire proposal provided by U.S.-led mediators in a blow to efforts to stop a devastating war that has gripped the African country for over 30 months. In video comments released by the military late Sunday, General Abdel Fattah Burhan said the proposal was unacceptable and the worst yet, accusing the mediators of being biased in their efforts to end the war. Sudan plunged into chaos in April 2023 when a power struggle between the military and the powerful paramilitary Rapid Support Forces exploded into open fighting in the capital Khartoum and elsewhere in the country. The devastating war has killed more than 40,000 people, according to UN figures, but aid groups say that it is an undercount and the true number could be many times higher. It created the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with over 14 million people forced to flee their homes, fueled disease outbreaks, and pushed parts of the country into famine. The mediators, known as the Quad, have been trying for over 2 years to bring an end to the fighting and reestablish a path to democratic transition, which was hampered by a military coup in 2021. They are comprised of the United States, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. This month, U.S. President Donald Trump said that he plans to put greater attention on helping find an end to Sudan's war after being urged to take action by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman during his visit to the White House. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an immediate ceasefire and for both the military and the RSF to negotiate a settlement. Writing on social platform X, he also called for a safe and unimpeded delivery of humanitarian aid as well as an end to arms and fighters transfer to Sudan. We need peace in Sudan, Guterres said. Massad Boulos, a U.S. advisor for African affairs, told the Associated Press earlier this month that the latest proposal calls for a 3-month humanitarian truce followed by a 9-month political process. The RSF said it has agreed to the truce following global outrage over the paramilitary's atrocities in the Darfur city of El Fasher. In a video speech late Monday, the paramilitary commander, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, reiterated the group's commitment to a 3-month humanitarian truce and called for mediators to pressure the military to accept the proposal. Burhan, Sudan's top general, said, however, that the proposal is considered the worst document yet, since it eliminates the armed forces, dissolves security agencies, and keeps the militia where they are, referring to the RSF. If the mediation continues in this direction, we will consider it to be biased mediation, he said. He lashed out at the U.S. advisor and accused him of attempting to impose some conditions on us. We fear that Massad Boulos will be an obstacle to the peace that all the people of Sudan seek, Burhan said, without giving further details about the plan. In his comments, Burhan also took aim at the UAE. He said that since the Quad includes the Gulf country as a member, the mediation group was not innocent of responsibility, especially since the entire world has witnessed the UAE support for the rebels against the Sudanese state. In a statement Monday, the UAE's foreign ministry said Burhan, through his rejection of the ceasefire proposal, showed obstructive behavior, which it said must be called out. The UAE is widely accused by rights groups of arming the paramilitaries. The AP reported earlier this month that U.S. intelligence assessments for many months have found that the Emirates, a close U.S. ally, has been sending weapons to the RSF, according to a U.S. official familiar with the classified reports, who spoke on condition of anonymity to share details. The UAE denies backing the paramilitaries. Burhan denied that the military is controlled by Islamists or that it used chemical weapons in its fighting against RSF, an accusation leveled by the Trump administration in May. Burhan said the military will only agree to a truce when the RSF completely withdraws from civilian areas to allow the return of displaced people to their homes before embarking on talks for a political settlement to the conflict. We're not warmongers, and we don't reject peace, he said. But no one can threaten us or dictate terms to us. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 25th issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Brian. Thank you for listening.